Harsha Walia is an activist, writer, and founder of the Vancouver chapter of No One is Illegal. She recently visited Halifax promoting her new book, Undoing Border Imperialism, a book about immigrant rights movements that take seriously issues of capitalism and settler colonialism. She starts off by telling us why Indigenous solidarity is important to her work.
All, if not most, movements have ignored Indigenous sovereignty, definitely not limited to immigrant rights struggles. And actually, historically, I mean, one of the ways in which settler colonialism and white supremacy operates is to actually invisibilize a lot of the alliances that have been built historically between migrant communities and Indigenous communities. So a lot of the work that I do and that others do is definitely not new in any way. You know, particularly in Vancouver, for example, where I live, which is unceded Coast Salish territories, there's actually a long and vibrant history, but often not known, for example, between early Chinese Canadians and Musqueam communities, and really deep alliances built between those communities and in really meaningful ways. So, for example, when the Chinatown riots were happening, a lot of Chinese Canadians were actually taken in by folks in the Musqueam community. And conversely, when, you know, de facto segregation, which continues, but when it was more explicit, I guess, segregation was occurring in various Vancouver neighborhoods where lots of restaurants wouldn't serve Indigenous people, Chinese restaurants, small family businesses would feed a lot of Musqueam folks. And so, you know, this is, so the work, I just, you know, want to highlight that the work that I'm doing is not new. It's built on a legacy of ancestral relationships between communities. And in terms of the importance of it, I think it's, you know, again, particularly for migrant justice movements and migrant communities, but not limited to those movements or communities, it's central to organize our movements in solidarity with Indigenous struggles, and to do so in a way that isn't about optional alliance, but it's to actually understand that we can't have any social or environmental justice movement that doesn't deal with the reality of settler colonialism, because every system of oppression is organized, within Canada at least, around settler colonialism. So if we look at poverty, poverty is, you know, is deliberate in the settler colonial context. Indigenous communities face deliberate impoverishment. It's not a coincidence that Indigenous communities and predominantly communities of color face mass impoverishment. Patriarchy within settler colonialism is organized around, you know, the destruction of Indigenous nationhood and the destruction of Indigenous families and the deliberate targeting of Indigenous women. Obviously, land destruction, environmental degradation is also part and parcel of settler colonialism. So we start to see that various seemingly diverse issues and seemingly diverse social movements can actually strengthen themselves by understanding settler colonialism as a pillar of all of these forms of oppression. And then specifically for migrant justice communities, it becomes important for a number of reasons. One is because, you know, of course, a lot of migrant communities, not all, but a lot of migrant communities come with a deep history of colonialism and capitalism. Often these aren't in settler colonial contexts. So it looks differently and it's organized differently, but certainly there's a legacy of colonialism. So for me, you know, being away from home, one of the ways in which I imagine myself as fighting kind of colonialism globally is very much to be rooted in a local struggle against colonialism. I think a lot of migrants can feel and understand that. And secondly is, you know, of course, the responsibility which is on all people to align ourselves with anti-colonial struggles on Turtle Island and to understand the ways in which we're complicit and, you know, and hence we become responsible for those forms of allyship. So I think it looks different for all communities and all movements, but in general, I think it's an imperative way to organize ourselves and to understand ourselves on Turtle Island.
Feminism is another sort of topic that's important in your work. And you had mentioned, when you were talking about the Indigenous struggles, you had mentioned patriarchy and the role. And I was wondering if you could just expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to speak specifically to the relationship between feminism and Indigenous struggles because I don't think that's appropriate. But I can speak kind of broadly to the ways in which I think feminism needs to really urgently reimagine itself. And so, you know, there's certainly the waves of feminism that have been critiqued for, you know, being primarily white and middle class and being really colonial in their conceptions of feminism. So this idea that feminism means equality for women, and equality for women is prescribed to achieving greater economic success and is essentially about being accommodated and achieving gains within capitalism and colonialism, for example. You know, that's not the majority of feminism today, or at least not in the movements that I'm part of. But even within, you know, what people imagine as a radical feminism or third wave feminism or a post-colonial feminism or all these different kind of labels, even within those forms of feminism, I think there's a lot lacking, because those forms of feminism understand anti-oppression, for example. So then, you know, the necessity to include the leadership of women of color, of poor women, of trans women, of indigenous women, of single mothers, etc. But I think what's lacking even still is that those forms of feminism don't understand how patriarchy is actually differently organized to affect these communities and to impact these communities, right? So it's not simply about understanding feminism as having this universal kind of impact, as having this equal impact across different communities of women, but actually understanding patriarchy as being actively differently organized. And so in the context of colonialism, for example, you know, patriarchy is organized in deep connection with violence against the land, yet feminism has not articulated the relationship between settler colonialism and patriarchy as organized around dispossession of land, and how colonialism very much, like I mentioned earlier, deliberately targets indigenous women and indigenous women's bodies, not simply as a form of patriarchy, but also as a form of colonialism. Because dispossessing women from the land means removing the front line of defense from the land. And, you know, there's other examples of the ways in which patriarchy is organized within labor, for example. And so feminism has traditionally understood fighting patriarchy or articulating a feminism as simply meaning better working conditions, for example, or more formal recognition within the labor market. But again, without understanding how actually capitalism is organized through patriarchy, and that the very kind of conception of capital accumulation is rooted in an understanding of a fundamentally anti-communitarian social organization of labor, which sounds like a lot of jargon, but we can, you know, look at examples like reproductive labor or domestic labor, all these forms of labor and emotional labor, all these forms of labor that have traditionally been carried by women in their communities and continue to be carried by women in their communities, but are not recognized as labor because both of patriarchy, but also of capitalism, because capitalism only values that as labor which can be commodified and can be privatized. And these forms of labor are fundamentally rooted in community, which is what capitalism aims to destroy through privatization and forms of social isolation. So, you know, those are just some examples of how I think feminism has not yet articulated a deeper understanding of how patriarchy is actually organized as not just something that's about violence against women or lack of equality between genders, but actually as organized through various forms of domination and oppression. I mean, definitely what I was saying is not an articulation of how everyone understands feminism or feminisms, as you said. And definitely, I think in particular, women of color, indigenous women, and poor and low-income women are kind of at the forefront. And poor women, you know, being a large category of women, including women in the sex trade and other women who are in informal economies, single mothers, etc., are articulating, you know, definitely their version of feminisms. I think what isn't happening, though, is the kind of big F feminisms, understanding and embracing those as actually feminism. So oftentimes, you know, struggles of women of color are seen as, you know, intersectional, right? So that the fact that this is an intersectional analysis. So it gets, I think actually intersectionality is not something that's helpful in some ways, because it means that we don't understand how things aren't just crossing each other, they're actually organized through each other. And that's kind of what I was trying to allude to, is that I think big F feminism has understood maybe the need to incorporate more voices, but not understood the deep ways in which these systems actually inform each other.
within movements themselves, so I mean within people who are ostensibly feminist, you know, do you think that there's any success in movements themselves to incorporate these understandings of feminism, or do you think that still, even in those places, is still a struggle?
I think it's a bit of both, and it depends on, you know, what movements people are part of. I mean, you know, so I'm, for example, a member of the Feb 14th Women's Memorial March Committee. And, you know, now, for example, there's an increasing awareness of the ways in which issues affecting missing and murdered Indigenous women in particular needs to be a part of, a core part of the feminist movement, and that this is a form of violence against women, but it, you know, has its specific contours as kind of colonial gendered violence. But, you know, there's also the deep reality that in the context of Vancouver, for example, this march has been going on now for 23 years. And so it's taken decades to even get a basic amount of recognition, if you will, let alone a deep commitment and action to organizing around these issues, right? This is still a movement that is led by Indigenous women, as it should be. But, you know, the kind of ability for allies to step up, whether within the feminist movement or movements in general, it's increasing, but it's still inadequate. So I think there's still lots of challenges to making sure that movements incorporated a deeper understanding of how patriarchy is affecting diverse women. Because again, sometimes it doesn't look like the way that Big F feminism needs it to look like in order to take it on.
You're listening to an interview with Harsha Walia, author of Undoing Border Imperialism. I asked her why she thinks it's important to reflect on the successes and failures within social movements.
Reflecting on social movements, it's important primarily for the reason that we just don't do it enough. And if we do it, it's in really kind of small insular networks, like our own collectives or our own groups or our own friends. You know, and it's a strange thing because there's lots of lessons that we can obviously learn from our failures, and also the critical need to share them. Like, I find that for me, the best ways that I've learned to organize have actually been through sharing of strategies, right? So we don't come up with these things in isolation. We do this work collectively. And so if we recognize we do this work collectively, then we also need to reflect and share on this work collectively. I think part of our hesitation too around reflexivity, I mean, part of it's the nature of organizing, right? Our organizing is really crisis oriented and immediate, and we don't often have the time. Like, we go from one thing to the other. Sometimes we don't have the luxury to stop in between. A lot of times it's also because a lot of movement theory has unfortunately come from within academia. So people have, you know, a lot of people that I know have an aversion to what's seen as kind of grassroots theory, because people see it as something that, you know, people see movements being researched all the time. So people conflate, I would argue, or what I've seen, conflate reflection as a part of, and the process of theorizing about movements, as something that's typically been abstracted from movements, right? It's something that outsiders do to movements. So then there's this aversion to wanting to engage in that process at all. So I think those are the challenges around movement reflections and reflexivity. But obviously it's critical. It's also particularly important if we want to build intergenerational movements in particular, because, you know, especially in North America, where the transience in movements is endemic, and a lot of that is structural, a lot of that is the way in which, you know, we're socially organized, that movements aren't able to sustain people as they get older because they're not organized in such a way, you know, which is its own challenge. But recognizing that that's a reality, reflexivity becomes particularly important if we want to build intergenerational networks of knowledge, so that each generation isn't coming up with the same challenges and thinking that they're alone in dealing with them. And so for me, I mean, doing this work around movement building is so critical, especially to address the fact that a lot of burnout, I think, also comes from being jaded and seeing the same mistakes being made over and over again. So if we see ourselves as, we may not be winning anymore, but if we can at least see ourselves thinking more critically about how we're engaging in our movements, then I do feel we'll be more likely to be present within movements because we see some kind of shifts within our organizing.
Have you had any success yourself, like within your own movements that you participate in building that kind of reflexivity in?
I think so. I mean, again, it's hard to say because movements are so large and diverse. But I do feel that not all, but certain movements that I've been part of have engaged in processes of reflection. And, you know, and there's also varying layers of reflection that are needed, right? There's layers needed around strategy, around tactics, around our internal organization. The ones that I feel the strongest, or that I feel have been reflected upon most strongly in spaces that I'm part of, or some of the spaces that I'm part of, are definitely have to do with forms of internal organization. And I think this is important because that's often the hardest one to reflect on, because it's the ones that are the most personal, right? It's not about just how the world is operating out there and how we deal with it. It's how we deal with each other in our personal relationships and dynamics in our organizing. And I think those are often the largest source of tension within most groups and collectives, because there isn't a way to do it. There's no way to talk about it. The ways in which we talk about it seem really general and abstract, you know, like leadership and structure. So those ones in particular, I find myself thinking about a lot, and spaces that I'm part of, I think, are dealing with it in good ways. Sometimes coming up with things at work, you know, and stumbling and failing and falling, but working through it. So I do feel hopeful, particularly on that front. For me, it's not the successful in that it necessarily works perfectly, but the success is marked in the engagement through process. So the fact that people are willing to work on it to some degree. And I think for me, it's particularly in the context of No One Is Legal in Vancouver, and the book kind of articulates this, is the development of this idea, and again, not in abstract, but through concrete practice, of how to understand leadership and how to understand structure. And so, you know, on the left, there's been a lot of conversation around leadership and how do we understand leaders? Is, you know, we don't want any leaders, there are no leaders. And on the flip side, there's the really hierarchical leader. And so within No One Is Legal, we've spent a lot of time talking about leadership, recognizing that, you know, anti-oppression calls on us to actually encourage leadership rather than deny it. Because one of the things, particularly in anarchist circles, is that the denial of leadership has meant that it just reproduces systems of oppression, right? So when we pretend that everyone is equal and there are no leaders, then we reproduce hierarchies around race and class and gender, etc. So it's understanding leadership as actually encouraging leadership from marginalized and frontline communities rather than denying those forms of leadership. And it also means, you know, dealing with the reality, which I think is often happens in groups, is that people have different capacities. And so how do we deal with the fact that some people naturally, through their increased engagement, become leaders within a group or an organization? And to both respect that work and to also figure out how to have that leadership then be accountable rather than perpetuating just a few people being in the know and carrying those relationships. So that's, you know, one example.
So maybe just to finish off, I would be interested to hear how you personally became politicized.
I mean, it's a process for sure, and continues to be a process. You know, continue to learn and continue to be politicized around different issues that aren't as familiar to me. But I think it primarily started around, or I think I became aware of it around my family's experience. So my grandfather fought against the British Raj in India, or what is now known as India. What was pre-partition India and Pakistan, so I'm deeply influenced by the freedom struggle in South Asia, and also aware of how, you know, that's something that's beautiful and courageous and gives me a lot of inspiration, because particularly in this period, only 50, 60 years later, we assume that, you know, freedom and independence movements just kind of happened and were inevitable, but really the kind of courage that it took for people to engage in these forms of freedom struggles were really deep. And also hearing from him just how violent and harmful actually a lot of those struggles were. And in particular, you know, the partition of India, the colonial partition of India and Pakistan, led to the loss of the lives and displacement of 2 million people. And so after the formal independence movement, there was a deep legacy of violence, of, you know, intergenerational displacement, of trauma, of rape that was happening in communities, of murders, communal violence in communities. And so, you know, seeing kind of all the sides of struggle, right? The parts that are courageous and brave and resilient and inspiring, and then the parts that are deeply traumatized and continue to live with those forms of intergenerational trauma in silence. You know, one thing I always remember is that my grandfather actually barely talked about his involvement or about the freedom struggle in general. And whereas for us, this was something we were so proud of, things that you were like, whoa, my grandfather gets to stand in the freedom fighters line at the train station. That's amazing. But it was something he didn't talk about. And so for me, my politicization has been dual in terms of a lot of pride of coming from this legacy and, you know, feeling that deeply, but also seeing the ways in which communities who struggle suffer just so deeply at a personal level, at an emotional level, at a psychological level, and, you know, at a spiritual level. So how do we, you know, build movements that are resilient and, you know, in fighting the system, but also in keeping ourselves whole as much as we can.
Why does your grandfather not talk about it?
I don't know. I presume just too heavy. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, obviously a lot of grandfathers don't talk about things, right? No, I mean, I think like my grandfather was in the war, and I mean, he doesn't talk about that, right? Yeah. Because it was very traumatic, whatever. So
yeah, around trauma. And yeah, and then also, you know, comes back to ideas around patriarchy too, right? The deep socialization to not talk about things that may have any kind of emotion attached to them, whether positive or negative. But I think for him, my sense is it leans more towards the side of the trauma, because he continued to be involved during partition and was involved in helping people cross from both sides of the border. And so I, you know, just hearing through other people the kinds of violence that happened during partition, and also just how deeply demoralizing it was for people, because you think you're part of this freedom struggle that will lead to freedom. And shortly after that, you know, 2 million people died and displaced within that period. You know, the kind of disillusionment that sets in is deep.
It must have been very exciting to write the book and then see it in print.
For me, the most exciting part of the book has been, or is, that it's quite collaborative. It includes, you know, about 30 different voices in different forms. And so, you know, coming back to movement building, the book isn't really, I don't think, or I hope isn't, just an exercise in terms of like intellectual theory, but it's much more about how do we actually build our movements and strengthen them. That's the part I'm excited about, is kind of expanding those zones and possibilities of movement-based conversation. So,
thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with activist and writer Harsha Walia, recorded while she was visiting Halifax. Her new book is called Undoing Border Imperialism. I'm Candida Hadley. Thanks for listening.